Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, October 29th. President Biden has landed in Europe for a high-stakes economic summit followed by a higher-stakes climate summit. Today he is meeting with Pope Francis in Rome. Biden probably could use some pastoral comforting after the week he's been having with Congress, right? Still no deal on his physical and human infrastructure package among the different factions of Democrats, a deal he was hoping all sides would embrace when he announced a revised framework for it yesterday. Keyword, I think.
Today, I'm pleased to announce that after months of tough and thoughtful negotiations, I know we have a historic economic framework.
I think we have a historic economic framework. Then he changed it to I know. Well, he may have the framework, but he doesn't have the agreement yet. Add to that the state of Florida suing Biden over his vaccine mandate for federal workers and contractors, the election Tuesday in the purple state of Virginia, which could be an indicator of the chances of Congress flipping next year to the GOP. And oh, by the way, remember the GOP? What about the risk to them when Biden's bills finally do pass, which they probably will, and every single Republican has to run next year on having voted against universal preschool, a monthly child tax credit, adding hearing aids to Medicare, climate protections when we're having extreme weather events all over the country, and maybe, still maybe, some amount of paid family leave? Is it good for them to have voted against all of those things once it comes to pass? With me now, USA Today, Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page. Hi, Susan. It's hard to know where to look first today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. It's great to be back with you.
And let's look first at the Republicans. If we can assume the human infrastructure social benefits bill will eventually pass, is there any hand-wringing on the red side of the aisle at all, or in purple states or purple congressional districts represented by Republicans, about being on the wrong side of history with a lot of the white working class and suburban voters, about whether they will lose the women in those families, especially even more than they did thanks to Trump in 2018 and 2020?
So there's not enough hand-wringing to make any Republican actually vote for the bill. You know, I think it's pretty clear this is going to be a party line vote. It'd be a surprise if it got Republican support. And the question about how it plays in next year's midterms, I think, depends on a couple things. Number one, have the benefits of these programs been clear to voters by the time the midterms come around? Some of these provisions will take some time to get into place. And the other thing is that the big issue? Or do we have a resurgence of COVID? Or do we have big economic problems that take precedence over the provisions of this bill? But yes, it is, I think, to your question, I think it does pose some risks for Republicans over the long haul, not enough, though, to make them vote for it.
And the tax aspects, they'll have to run on, you know, the idea, which I guess is what they're saying now, you tell me, that this eventual package for childcare, et cetera, is too expensive for the millionaires and billionaires who they tried to save from a tax hike. That won't affect the lifestyles of those people who would have gotten the tax hike, plus the corporations. Is that what the Donald Trump, Steve Bannon populist base is really going to go to the polls for?
Well, Brian, I guess I would be surprised if they pitched it quite the way you formulated it, that they protected the multimillionaires. I think it's more likely that they might say, look what's happened with inflation. Is inflation still a problem? It's become more of a problem now than the Biden administration initially thought it would be. Or how are things going in terms of job growth? I mean, those are the economic issues that Republicans are likely to run on. So you tell me, is the economy going to look really good a year from now? Or will there be problems that have concerned a lot of Americans and raised issues, legitimate issues about leadership on a national scale of our economy?
And before we go back to the Democrats, I saw historian John Meacham on TV this morning on MSNBC referring to the 1980s when President Reagan had his big tax cut bill that most Democrats opposed, but he did pick off enough Democrats in swing districts where members felt pressure from their constituents who thought it was a good idea. Why is today so different from that?
Because compared to today, the 1980s looked like a golden age of bipartisanship. You know, that was, we didn't realize it at the time. But at that point, there were still conservative Democrats and there were still liberal Republicans. And those are both species that have left the stage.
I guess the conservative Democrats and the liberal Republicans are now the Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema wing of the Democratic Party. Would that be fair to say?
And, well, you know, when you think about conservative Democrats, there's maybe just one, and that would be Joe Manchin. Now, he turns out to be extraordinarily powerful in a 50-50 Senate. But it is if in were to retire, there is almost no prospect that another conservative Democrat would be elected to replace him. He almost certainly would be replaced by a Republican. And that's one reason that some Democrats are willing to cut him a little slack. In a way, they really aren't Senator Sinema, whose motivations and behavior here has been subject to a lot more criticism.
Let's play a few more clips of President Biden yesterday. He's talking here like he already has a final agreement, which he doesn't, but eventually this will probably apply. Listen.
No one got everything they wanted, including me. But that's what compromise is. That's consensus. And that's what I ran on.
So he's emphasizing that nobody got everything they wanted, including him. But this is still a moving target, apparently. So he doesn't know exactly what people got and didn't get. Can we do the latest edition, Susan, of what's in, what's out, and what's still in dispute? What struck you as new on that in the framework the president released? And then I'll ask you about a few specific ones.
Well, I think that they decided to focus on three priorities. And that meant that anything that didn't fit in these three baskets had a very tough time making this package. The three things they've decided to focus on, number one, climate change. $555 billion in climate change initiatives designed to increase the number of electric cars and move utilities away from using coal. That is a huge climate change program and the guts of this bill. Second big element, I think, involves kids. Universal pre-K, you know, almost half of American pre-kindergartners do not participate in a preschool program. So this is a big expansion of this, which would be universal pre-kindergarten, big child care proponent, and an expansion of Pell Grants for kids who are college students. So that's the second focus. The third is the Affordable Care Act. And this is one place where the rubber really met the road in these negotiations, because this bill focuses on expanding and fortifying the Affordable Care Act, not on expanding Medicare, which, of course, has been Bernie Sanders' big hope. It increases subsidies through the exchanges for people who are haven't been quite poor enough to get the subsidies, but are still met with this requirement to buy health insurance and have had many of them trouble doing so. And also a kind of workaround to help poor people in the states, in the 12 states, the 12 Republican states, red states, that declined to expand Medicaid coverage. This provides a way to provide Medicaid coverage for those people. Those are the three big things that this bill would do.
That's a lot. And we'll talk about how much, you know, sort of how much a lot that really is and how people should view this compromise if it comes down in that way. But a couple of specifics. Earlier this week, the reporting was that the Medicare expansion that would include vision, dental, and hearing services was entirely out. Today I read hearing is back in. Do you know if that's right?
Well, that is what I heard yesterday from one of the advocacy groups for hearing. So they were delighted that had survived. And that is, of course, a less expensive, a crucial thing for people on Medicare who need hearing aids and may not be able to afford them. But it's less expensive than, say, the dental provisions, the expansion of dental care. That was always going to be a tough thing to do once the bill got smaller. So yes, my understanding is, and as you said, this, you know, there could be some tweaks and negotiations before this actually gets over the finish line. My understanding is hearing is in, dental is out.
So now they'll be able to hear that their implants won't be covered when their teeth fall out. Also, earlier this week, it was reported that paid family leave was entirely out, but Senator Gillibrand and others don't appear to be taking that sitting down. What's the status of paid family leave?
Yeah, it's something that Nancy Pelosi talked about yesterday, too, that she has not given up on. So I think that might be one of the provisions that is still in a little bit of flux. And it's not it can be handled in a way that makes it not one of the most expensive things to do. So I think you might want to take kind of a wait and see attitude on what happens at the end of the day with that.
And here are a few lines from a New York Times analysis of where things are today. It says the more conservative Democratic holdouts, Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, it says they delivered half-hearted statements that pointedly did not promise that they would support the president's new framework. And about the more progressive members, it says they ignored the president's entreaties to vote on the physical infrastructure bill by yesterday, signaling their continued mistrust of moderate Democratic senators, whom they fear will not back Mr. Biden's larger social spending bill when it finally comes to a vote. So did you see what the Times called Manchin and Sinema's half-hearted statements?
Well, they praised the deal, and they said progress was being made, but they did not say, and therefore I will vote for it. And, you know, the issues that we're seeing now are, we've moved from the issues of the content of the two bills to distrust between progressive and moderate Democrats toward one another, and suspicion between House Democrats and toward their Senate colleagues about whether they will, at the end, whether they will do what they are saying they will do, whether they'll do what President Biden promised they would do, which is vote for this compromise package. Now it's not, you know, the debate at this moment, it's not about so much about content, it's about sequencing. And if I do this first, can I trust you to do that second? One thing to note about that is that this is not a new problem. And I think back to the debate over the Affordable Care Act, which has some similarities to what we see today, that before the House agreed to pass a compromised version of the Affordable Care Act, Nancy Pelosi demanded that Harry Reid get a letter signed by all the Democratic senators promising that they would go ahead and pass this a second bill that had been promised. Just them promising it was not enough to convince House Democrats. They wanted a piece of paper with senators' names on it. And Harry Reid got that, showed it to Pelosi. I think he kept it in his desk drawer, not in hers. But that was necessary to get the Affordable Care Act over the finish line. We're seeing that same dynamic now. You know, forget Republicans and Democrats. This is all about Democrats and Democrats. It's all about the House versus the Senate.
Susan, I think it goes underreported that in the new slimmed down $1.7-ish trillion version of the bill, from what I've read, $500 billion of it, so almost a third of it, is for climate change prevention, right, and adaptation.
That's right, $555 billion in climate change incentives and programs. That's more than we've ever spent on climate change before. It is a huge investment. It is the biggest single element in this bill. And, you know, Dennis makes a good point, and I think there are probably Republicans like him and independents like Mike who just wonder where their party is at the moment, that Mike is concerned Democrats have gone too far left and Dennis that the Republicans have gone too far right. So which party suits them? Maybe neither one at the moment. But at this time in Washington, it's very tribal. It is very hard to get now that Democrats control the House and Senate, very hard to get any Republicans to support anything that Democrats are pushing. It is true that the infrastructure bill, which is expected to pass if they could ever get it to the floor of the House, will have some Republican support. But we don't expect to see that with the reconciliation bill.
I wonder if you could do one fact check on something that Biden said in the speech yesterday, and based on the caller we just had, you know, describing as a moderate Republican how he thinks most Republicans today have kind of lost touch with the real economics of climate change, et cetera. Mostly what they'll talk about is the potential impact of this social spending bill on the deficit. And this comment by Biden yesterday is about whether it will add to the deficit at all. Listen.
Over the next 10 years, it will not add to the deficit at all. It will actually reduce the deficit, according to economists.
Susan, is that claim based on solid independent projections?
Well, it's based on the Democratic calculation of the impact of this bill, and it includes some increased money for enforcement by the IRS. And my understanding is that when the Joint Tax Committee does their calculation on what the bill will cost, they will not accept that as a revenue measure, although Democrats do. But yes, Democrats can show you a spreadsheet that explains how they say this will not increase the deficit, that the burden of this will go on corporations, which will face a 15% minimum corporate tax, and on a surtax on multimillionaires, and on this increased enforcement by the IRS.
Susan, how much of the Republican resistance to the social spending bill is consistent with real facts from history when other social programs that targeted poor people were opposed in Congress? It's largely by the white Republican Party, the overwhelmingly white Republican Party, and in no small measure because they think this is going to take my money and give it to undeserving black people. How much is that going on this time?
So first of all, when we talk about the price tag, which we think is going to be about $1.85 trillion, we should say that's over 10 years. I think that's a fair point. We shouldn't shorthand it and just assume people know that. I think that the impact and influence of racism is something that is a big part of our history. But I feel presumptuous in assuming that that's what's behind some of the opposition to this bill, because you could legitimately feel that this is an expansion of the federal role in American life that you don't support philosophically. There's a philosophical debate in this country that is legitimate and not racial. So I don't want to assume that every opponent of this bill is motivated by feeling like it's going to help black and brown people too much.
There's so much else I wanted to get to. We're going to run out of time. Let me at least get to this one more clip of Biden. Because I know for all the drama over these negotiations, that is how these things get done. And here's Biden trying to remind people to focus not on the normal divisions along the way, but the likely result in the larger context of American history.
I know it's hard. I know how deeply people feel about the things that they fight for. But this framework includes historic investments in our nation and in our people. Any single element of this framework would be viewed as a fundamental change in America. Taken together, they're truly consequential.
So, Susan, how are you approaching this as a journalist, as a Washington bureau chief? The drama and divisions are real. But any version of the bill, as it's now being discussed, is still epic. Can we report both things at once? Can we hold those two thoughts in our brain and communicate them to the public?
We could do our best. I think it's true. This is a big, consequential package. And assuming it gets through, and we think that is likely, but of course nothing's guaranteed until it's done, it's going to create a big legacy for President Biden. That's over the long term. You look at the short term, it looks pretty messy. His leadership has sometimes not been as sure-footed as some people assumed. And one person is especially dismayed by the short term, and that would be Terry McAuliffe, who is running for governor of Virginia in a race Democrats thought they were going to win. At this moment, it looks like he may win, but may well lose in a loss that will be seen, fairly or not, as a sign of the concern of voters like Mike, who we heard from, who voted for Biden, voted for Democrats, but are unhappy where things stand now.
But I will say that I'm skeptical about any election that takes place before these bills are passed as indicators of what the politics of 2022 are going to be in congressional elections after these bills have passed, assuming they do. I tend to think the implications of Virginia are being overreported, but you're much closer to this than I am. So how do you think how do you see the importance of Virginia's elections in this bubble moment where this bill is on the verge, but it's not yet enacted?
Well, the thing is, if you look at history, Virginia can certainly signal what's going to happen in a year. And a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans point back to 2009, the off-year Virginia election after President Obama took office. Republicans won that election. That was followed the next year by Democrats losing 63 seats in the House and control of the House of Representatives. And you know, you've got a much tighter situation in both the House and the Senate looking at next year. You don't need to lose 63 seats to lose control of the House. If you're a Democrat, you need to lose 5. Mm. So history says that next year's midterms are going to be tough for Democrats. And that's one reason I think there's so much attention on what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks, because after that, everything just gets harder.
Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. And you know what? I should have mentioned your book that you were on for recently, so I'm going to let you give the title, your wonderful biography of Nancy Pelosi.
It's called Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. And you see her applying those lessons day and night this week.
Susan, thanks as always.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.